The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Anthony Doerr, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth, a partnership between NHPR and the Music Hall. Doerr's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, All the Light We Cannot See, tells the stories of two teenagers swept up in the brutality of World War II. Much has been made of the fact that it took Doerr 10 years to write the book. But during our time at the Music Hall, it became clear that the novel was just one facet and one result of his free-range inquisitiveness and sense of wonder. Anthony Doerr stood to one corner of the stage with an excitable restlessness beside a giant screen where he showed a variety of slides to help tell the story of how the novel came to be. The first image was an old family photo, a little boy clad in suspenders, oversized glasses, and a plastic Mickey Mouse hat.
I was an unusual kid. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, 400 miles from the nearest ocean, but I collected seashells. By the time I was 7, I couldn't hit a baseball to save my life, but I'd performed enough chores in my mom's garden that I could tell the difference between impatiens, trailing vincas, and petunias. By the time I was 10, I knew the name and number of every single player on the 1983 Cleveland Browns, but I also went to bed reading Carl Sagan and Charles Darwin. When folks would ask what I wanted to be when I grew up, my answer would depend entirely on whatever book I happened to be reading at the moment. I read Jack London's The Call of the Wild and decided that I needed to become a mail carrier in the Yukon. For a week that January, I slept with the window of my bedroom open to prepare my body for the cold until my dad figured out why the house was freezing and put an end to that. Then I read George Plimpton's Paper Lion. Do you guys know this book? He was a journalist who wormed his way into the Detroit Lions for the preseason. The players didn't know he was a journalist, but the coaches did. He managed to take 5 snaps, a quarterback at an inter-squad scrimmage, and lose significant yards on all 5. I love that detail. After I read that, I was determined to become a punt returner in the NFL until my brother started tackling me after I tried to return their punts, and a broken arm put an end to that. For a year, I kept an aquarium full of frogs and tadpoles and bluegill in my bedroom because I'd read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and was determined to become a marine biologist. But then someone bought me a book about Frank Lloyd Wright, and I promptly traded the aquarium to my brother for all of his Legos and started telling my folks that I wanted to be an architect. This equivocation was not something that I outgrew. During my first year in college, I took Latin American studies, philosophy, and sociology. During my second year, I took nutrition, the civil rights movement, astronomy, and religious studies. To me, the course catalog was kind of like an all-you-can-eat buffet. There wasn't a thing in there that I didn't want on my plate. But by the end of sophomore year, for some reason, they wanted me to declare a major. I made an appointment, this is true, with the assistant dean to talk about the errors of such a strange requirement. Assistant Dean was this tall, severe woman in a green suit. She told me she wasn't prepared to abolish the policy of having students complete requirements for a major field of study. Started flipping through papers on her desk. I asked if maybe she could cut down the number of courses that I have to take in a major so I could take more electives. She asked me if I knew the definition of the word dilettante. I said no. She said, look it up. And then she said that the next time I come into her office, I might be more persuasive if I wear a different shirt, one that had sleeves on it. It also, I think, said, give blood, play rugby on it. It's very classy t-shirt. So I reluctantly declared myself a history major, but before I graduated, I still managed to sneak in Russian and constitutional law and architecture and environmental science 101. All of which meant that when I graduated, most of my friends went and got jobs. And I drove with a buddy who's here to Telluride, Colorado, and cooked calamari in a deep fryer and skied moguls every day for 80 days straight. Then I drove to New Jersey to visit my oldest brother. He had recently finished two masters and a PhD at MIT in electrical engineering. I would never, ever be accused of being a dilettante. He had just been hired as an optics researcher at Bell Labs. He showed me his lab, which is full of lasers, none of which I was allowed to touch. And then he took me upstairs into this dark room. He flipped a bunch of switches and turned on a monitor on this big machine. The machine was an electron microscope, electron scanning microscope. And that is the eye of a housefly, at extreme magnification. Housefly eyes are amazing. There's a reason it's so hard to swat those things. Thousands of tiny images coalesce into one visual image in their brains, and this enables them to see even the slightest movements in an extremely wide field. They can see almost 360 degrees, and they can sense movement in extremely low light. Plus, they can see polarized light, all these things we can't do. We think we're so great and at the top of the animal kingdom, but their eyes are in many ways more sophisticated than ours. One of my brother's colleagues came in that day and he explained that the motion center in the fly's brain is about 1/6 of a cubic millimeter of brain matter, and yet it can process massive amounts of information about movement in real time. At least at that time, no computer, even one he said the size of a station wagon, possessed that kind of computational power. Sometimes we get stuck in our own heads and our own lives and the scale of our own hours, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, and you forget that our systems of perception are just one way of experiencing the world. We forget what's possible. What do you think the most abundant vertebrate on the planet is? So something with a backbone. Can't be an insect. At first, I thought mouse or rats, right? Then I thought, maybe it's chickens. But the most common vertebrate on the planet is a fish. It's the bent-tooth bristlemouth, tiny bioluminescent fish that lives in deep ocean water. If your brain is like mine, you were being a terrestrial chauvinist and trying to think of land animals, and we were forgetting that the seas are on average 2.5 miles deep, which just means that 99% of the biosphere, a fancy word for space inhabitable by Earth's creatures, exists in the oceans. And 85% of that is beyond the reach of sunlight. So by far, the most common place to live on Earth is not the desert or the forest or a city, but in the vast, cold, and fluid environment that is the deep sea. Which maybe will lead you to my last question. What do you think the most common form of communication is on Earth? What do you think the most common way one member of a species lets another member know that it's in danger or that it's randy? Song is what I thought. Sound, right? Vibration of some type, but that was wrong. Most common form of communication on Earth is light, bioluminescence. 90% of deep sea animals create their own light. And we know so little about them, in almost every way, they remain mysteries to us. For the last 25 years, a new deep sea species has been discovered on average every 2 weeks.
You're listening to Anthony Doerr, the Pulitzer Prize winning author of All the Light We Cannot See. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage.
I've loved reading about the deep ocean since I was a boy, reading 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, but I wasn't able to put together a good piece of writing about it until I'd worked on something for well over a decade, finally turned it into a publishable short story called The Deep. Even as a boy, I was fascinated by hibernation, the strange middle ground it presents between sleep and death, but it wasn't until I'd worked on drafts for years that I managed to transform a bunch of pages about hibernating animals into a functional short story that became part of my first book. Same is true with whale strandings. Why do whales commit suicide if that's what they're doing? A question that also factored into my first book, The Shell Collector. And the way memories are made. Why do certain memories remain intact in Alzheimer's patients while others wither? Why, for example, long after my grandmother had forgotten my name, could she still beat the pants off me at Gin Rummy? A question I examined in my fourth book, Memory Wall. In each of these projects, I tried to find questions that fascinated me and that helped me see the familiar world in an unfamiliar way, but it wasn't until I tried to build stories up around those questions that anybody became interested in what I was writing. What I had to learn during the long apprenticeship, since my brother showed me the eye of a housefly, was that to reach readers to share how dazzled I felt by our world, I had to learn to relate things on human scales and through human eyes. I had to give my questions to my characters. You can't just tell a reader, this is awesome. You have to help your reader feel awe. And I think the way to do that is to transfer the amazement I feel for various subjects into the hearts of fictional characters. I try to let my own enthusiasm for something deeply interesting in the world seep into their lives, and then hopefully, like a virus, into the life of a reader. Which brings me to the reason a lot of you showed up today. Winter day, almost 13 years ago now, when I had a one-year thing at Princeton, so I took a train from Princeton, New Jersey, to New York City. It's like an hour. I just completed the book that had started with my fascination with snow. I was searching around for a new idea. I had a little notebook open in my lap. So this is 2004. Back then, Donald Trump's ambitions were a little bit smaller. The man in the seat in front of me was talking to somebody on his 2004-ish cell phone about the sequel to The Matrix Revolutions, it was called. As we pulled into Penn Station, you're going like 50 miles an hour and you're going underground. Steel and concrete are flowing above the train. His call dropped, and he got angry. In my opinion, he got unreasonably angry. Started swearing and rapping his phone with his knuckles. After I stopped fearing for my safety for a moment, I said to myself what he's forgetting, but really what we're all forgetting anytime we use one of these things, is that what he's doing is a miracle. He's using two little radios, a receiver and a transmitter, crammed into something no bigger than a deck of cards, to send and receive little packets of light between hundreds of radio towers, one after the next, miles apart, each connecting to the next at the speed of light. And he's using this magic to have a conversation about Keanu Reeves. I thought because we're habitualized to it, we've stopped seeing the grandeur of this breathtaking act. The magic of it has bled away. So I decided to try to write something that would help us feel that power again, to feel the strangeness and the sorcery of hearing the voice of a stranger or a distant loved one in our heads. So that very afternoon, almost 13 years ago now, I wrote a title in my notebook. Titles usually come slow to me, but in that case, I had the title before I had anything else.
And that title? All the Light We Cannot See. You've been listening to Anthony Doerr, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. After the break, we'll talk about how he found the setting, the time period, and the characters for what would become a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. I'm Virginia Prescott. Stay with us for Writers on a New England Stage with Anthony Doerr, a special edition of Word of Mouth from NHPR. We spoke to Anthony Doerr shortly after his blockbuster book, All the Light We Cannot See, was released in paperback after spending nearly 3 years on the New York Times bestsellers list. The novel flips back and forth in time and primarily between two characters, Marie-Laure LeBlanc, a resourceful blind girl who flees the German occupation of Paris with her beloved father, and Werner Fenning, a German orphan whose genius for electrical circuitry saves him from a life in the coal mines and thrusts him into an elite Nazi training school, and later to wiping out pockets of Allied resistance. Marie-Laure and Werner's respective stories unfold in short, elegant chapters that converge during the Allied bombardment of Brittany in the seaside town of Saint-Malo at the end of World War II.
Sésambre Island in the harbor of Saint-Malo, where resisting Nazis blocked Allied use of Saint-Malo's port, first of Brittany's harbors isolated after the breakthrough from Normandy. Nazis repeatedly ignored requests to surrender.
On stage at the Music Hall, Anthony Doerr talked about how shards of inspiration and found images and a magical walk on a dark night evolved into a novel, a journey that begins with a dive into physical science.
Visible light, as you probably know, the light we can see, is an infinitesimal fraction of all the light that's streaming through our atmosphere every second. Bracketing visible light shines so much light we cannot see X-rays and cosmic rays and microwaves and radio waves, ultraviolet rays. Indeed, this is amazing to me. The light that we can see, color, the way we drive our cars and see our lovers, comprises less than 1/10 trillionth of all the light that's out there. So that night, after I got back to Princeton from New York, all I had was that title, and I just started a piece of fiction in which a girl reads a story to a boy over a radio. I conceived of her as blind and him as trapped in darkness, and the sound of her voice carried by that invisible light as his salvation. For months, I played around with this story. I liked the parallel of the two of them in supposed darkness, her blind, him in blackness. And even in those early drafts, I had a sense that she could see things he could not, that she was maybe in every way, in almost every way, a more capable human being than he was. I soon found myself trying to tell a story that might express not just how limited our view of the world is in terms of our physical senses, but also in terms of the way we see the world politically, culturally, and scientifically. But I didn't yet know where and when this thing would be set. I didn't know what stories she'd be reading to him over the radio. I didn't know why I was trapped. I didn't really yet know who they were. Then over a year later, I went to France on book tour. Okay, I'll just quickly tell you that French book tours are very different than American book tours. For example, in the States, if you're like going to go on FM radio to ask about your book, you know, they'd be like, Anthony Doerr, welcome to WMMS. Can you tell us what your book is about? You have 14 seconds. You know. You're like, well, there's a girl, and they're like, thanks so much, thank you. You know, Witchy Woman by the Eagles. Right? That's America. But in France, they have like a primetime show on Thursday nights about books where like the host is super handsome and famous. And you go, like, you go on the radio in France, and they're like, Anthony, you know, welcome, you know, we have 1 hour, no commercials. What is your theory of beauty? You're like, oh. Late in the tour, we went to Brittany. I had never been to Brittany. I had never been to Saint-Malo. I'd never heard of it. It was dark when we arrived, and they put us in a restaurant with journalists and everybody smoking. And eventually, I just kind of ducked down the back and walked up 3 flights of stairs because I couldn't take the secondhand smoke anymore. And found myself atop the ramparts encircling this amazing town. It was low tide. The tides are huge there. The tide was out almost a mile. The low tide beaches were glimmering in the moonlight. The lamps were glowing. And I felt as if I had stumbled into an imaginary city, a place that was part fairy tale castle, part M.C. Escher etching, if you remember those etchings, part mist and ocean wind and lamplight. The next day, we had the day off. So I walked the city for like 12 hours around it. And through it, and I fell under the spell of these old granite mansions, centuries-old houses of former pirates and fishermen and sea captains. And like a foolish American might, I said to my editor, it's amazing to walk through a city so old. He said, actually, Saint-Malo was almost entirely destroyed at the end of the Second World War in 1944, primarily by American bombs and artillery. That's when I thought, maybe I found the place where my boy with his radio could be trapped listening to the blind girl on the radio. What I wondered was it like to live through a bombardment, and what in particular was it like for children? So off I went for another year reading about the siege of Saint-Malo and the German fortifications of the Atlantic Wall and the occupation of France. I had to give myself another college education, so to speak. I read about radio waves and American artillery companies and French snails and the invasion of Paris 4 years before in June of 1940, which in turn got me reading about the massive effort to protect Europe's cultural treasures against the Nazis. With almost no notice, the whole city of Paris had to start shipping its valuables out of town. So I started imagining that the girl and her father might have fled Paris from the Natural History Museum carrying something of great value. So now, after several years of being a dilettante in about 40 different subjects, I finally had a fair amount of the girl's backstory figured out and started work on her narrative in earnest, sending her to Saint-Malo, where I decided she'd have a great uncle and could safely wait out the war there. In the meantime, I needed to work on the boy's story. I knew now that I wanted him to be from the other side of the war so that their intersection would be fraught and unlikely. So I started reading about the kinds of things that might have affected the life of a young person in Germany in the 1930s. And since I was reading about radio, one of the things I found rather quickly was this line of radio receivers called the People's Receivers. These were state-sponsored and subsidized radios, which is just a clever way of saying the government helped manufacturers make them cheaper. They had deliberately reduced the sensitivity so that it would be hard to get foreign broadcasts. They were incapable of shortwave, and they were only marked for German and Austrian stations. As early as 1932, Goebbels could see how invaluable it would be to make radio reception affordable. Radios were too expensive for most folks in the depressed Germany in which Hitler came to power. At 76 Reichsmarks, it was half the price of other receivers on the market, and it was cool. It had a pretty early form of plastic in it. Kids in particular wanted it in their kitchens, wanted their parents to get it, and became very popular. They would sell 7 million of these Volksempfangers, they were called, this model by 1939. Later, they came out with an even cheaper model, which only cost about half the price. Eventually, these machines were a crucial tool in depriving millions of people of the ability to think critically and independently. In 1939, it became punishable by hard labor in Germany to listen to foreign broadcasts, and by 1944, towards the end of the war, the Gestapo was running a brutal campaign advertising shortwave radios and then arresting and shooting the people who bought them. And, of course, I started reading about the Hitler Youth, how German school weeks were reorganized so that Wednesday evenings and Saturdays were reserved for youth activities, how compulsory service became mandatory for boys and then girls, too. And about paramilitary schools that had been created by the Nazis for the quote-unquote racially elite. Schools where boys, and in a few cases girls, were painstakingly brainwashed into becoming violent and unquestioning machines. All along I kept asking myself what would become one of the central questions of the novel. Is it right to do something just because everybody else is doing it? And all along, I worried, how could I take a World War II story, a period about which so much has been written, and try to make it feel new again? Could I ask myself and my readers to empathize as deeply with a German boy as I could with a French girl? 6 years into the project, still no real end in sight, to my wife's great thrill, I'm sure, when I came across this photograph. This is Hans-Georg Henke. He was 15 years old here in 1945. He was captured by the United States 9th Army in Rechtenbach, Germany. It's in Bavaria. His father had died in 1938, and his mother had died in 1944, and he joined an anti-air squad to support himself. I pinned this photo to the wall in my office, and the longer I looked at it, the more I started to see. His uniform's too big for him, perhaps inherited from somebody who no longer needed it. And it just seems to me, the more I started to try to imagine it, it just seems to me that everything he was told growing up, perhaps even on one of these radios that I showed you, is turning out to not be true. I was not used to feeling empathy for German citizens during the war. Indeed, in many ways, growing up, I had been encouraged not to. But I decided to try to use the lessons that I've been learning all along as I was coming up as a writer. I tried to invest some of my own passions in the boy, particularly the amazement I felt and feel at the miracle of radio. As you might know, there are 187 chapters in the final version of the novel. Many of them are shorter than a single page, and they alternate back and forth between the girl, who I named Marie, and the boy, who I named Werner. The book embraces my childhood love for lots of different things, flowers and birds and puzzles and mazes, and because I wanted the shape of the book to mimic a labyrinth, to echo, for example, the forms of the puzzle boxes that Marie's father builds for her, it took a full decade to solve all the puzzles of its structure. I wanted my readers to re-see things that we take for granted, things that have become so familiar to us that we no longer see them clearly, things like electromagnetic communication or bread or the freedom to walk to a bakery or out onto a beach or just the freedom to be able to listen to whatever music we'd like to listen to. I even wanted to try to remind myself and the reader that the simple act of seeing can be miraculous and strange if we look at the world with new eyes.
You're listening to Anthony Doerr, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of All the Light We Cannot See. Our conversation was recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage.
80 days ago, although it may seem like 80 weeks to some of us, we inaugurated a new president. Though I don't believe America is the scene of carnage that our president described in his inaugural address, it's not hard to observe that he has come to power in an alarming time. Last year was the warmest year in the 137 years that the NOAA has been recording surface temperatures. Climate refugees are on the move on every continent. Manufacturing jobs that used to offer American workers decades of stability are now often executed overseas or by machines. High school diplomas are no longer adequate tickets to steady employment. And according to the New York Times last month, half of the American men who have dropped out of the workforce take pain medication on a daily basis. At a time when rapid accelerations in global interconnection mean tremors in Greek markets can send 401ks in Portsmouth crashing, who can blame people for becoming anxious? Who hasn't felt the urge to lock the door, climb into a womb of Netflix, and pull a figurative Brexit from the world? Unfortunately, the dream of cutting ourselves off, the dream of isolationism, is just that. It's a dream, one that's no longer practical. We live in an interdependent world. The iPhone in your pocket is assembled from components made by 200 different suppliers in places as disparate as Thailand, Malaysia, the Czech Republic, the United States, South Korea, and the Philippines. Emissions from China interfere with the air over California. The shirt you're wearing may have been to more countries in Asia than you have. And pieces of the plastic bottle I threw away just a couple hours ago at Logan Airport will be in the ground or in the ocean when my great-grandchildren are running around. The truth is that in 2017, the more we can remember how interconnected we all are, the more we can train ourselves to empathize with the kids in our neighborhoods, beyond our borders, and in our futures, the better off we'll be. There are a thousand ways to remind ourselves of that interdependence. Of course, we can get to know our police officers, we can bring our neighbors soup when they're sick, we can serve people who are less privileged than we are, we can travel, we can ask questions of the people cleaning our hotel rooms, we can volunteer at the library, you can come and support stuff like this. But there's one activity that has reliably reminded and educated me about human interconnectedness, it's reading. Without stories, we can get trapped in the prison of the familiar. All we would know is the normal, me, and the stereotype, the other. And so much of today's rhetoric, whether it's from the right or the left, the collective becomes everything. We gets defined against they. Throughout history, systematic hatred, whether it's perpetrated by slave owners, Nazis, the Taliban, the KKK, Boko Haram, or the extremists that we're currently calling ISIS, depends on objectifying people into groups, dismantling its adherents' abilities to understand and share the feelings of other people, and minimizing the complexity of the individual. But in novels and stories and poems, we celebrate the individual. Novels, I believe, are uniquely qualified to offer compassion, empathy, and attentiveness. The lesson of every single one of my favorite novels is this: the truth is more complicated than I thought. If you find the right book, you can breach the walls of your skull and transcend the barriers of culture, race, class, and time. You can live the life of Hamlet or Hester Prynne or Huckleberry Finn. And if you keep practicing this skill, if you keep relearning the lesson that no one is normal, no one is usual, no one is ordinary, when you need it most, your imagination will be nimble and ready, capable of airlifting you out of the confines of yourself and dropping you into the life of whomever you choose, whether it's the neighbor who voted for the candidate you didn't care for, or the migrant worker who harvested the strawberry you're about to eat, or the child not so far from here who isn't sure where her next meal will come from. I'm not the first person to suggest that the imagination is a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it'll get. And in the months and years to come, we're going to need our imaginations more than ever. I hope it's not too bold to suggest that through novels, short stories, and poems, we can expand our imaginations, combat unilateralism and stereotype, deepen our experiences of life, and even in incremental but important ways, nudge the world toward goodness. Thanks, guys.
Anthony Doerr, reported live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. I'm Virginia Prescott. When we come back, I will ask the author of All the Light We Cannot See about creating Nazi characters who aren't caricatures and are even sympathetic, and where he draws the line between historical accuracy and fiction. That's when this special edition of Word of Mouth continues on NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Anthony Doerr, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Doerr's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, All the Light We Cannot See, tells the stories of two teenagers engulfed by the horrors of World War II. 14-year-old Marie-Laure is blind and hiding out with her family in the Breton coastal town of Saint-Malo. Werner is an engineering prodigy who survives the abject cruelty of Hitler Youth training to serve the Reich. In the character of Werner, Doerr achieves something rarely done in war stories, creating a Nazi we can sympathize with. Marie-Laure and Werner's lives intersect late in the novel in a plot that is driven by radio, which we applaud, and by the relentless drive of a Nazi treasure hunter named Sergeant Major von Rumpel to find the Sea of Flames. That is a priceless diamond that allegedly endows its keeper with eternal life, while leaving all those beloved by the holder cursed. Before the break, Anthony Doerr talked about the outlines of characters and threads of plot and notions of place that he eventually wove together into the novel All the Light We Cannot See. I joined him on stage for an interview that included questions submitted by the audience. Anthony, I was going to start with your theory of beauty, but we don't have an hour, so I'm going to get to some of the other questions.
Okay.
It's interesting learning a little bit about the origins of this book, that you had the idea of radio, you had the blind girl, you had all of these elements before you arrived at World War II. And so many people began with an idea of writing a book about World War II and the battles. So how did that change your perspective? And by the way, do we need another book about World War II?
Right. At one point I was working on the novel, a friend told me that if you ripped all the pages of all the books written about the Second World War and dropped them on Germany, it would cover the entire country. And so, you know, that just inserts this mosquito of doubt. Not that I didn't have 100 in there already, but I'm like, why would I ever want to add one more? So I think, you know, it's kind of what I was trying to say there. You're just trying to find, tunnel, if there is anything universal, you're just finding it by tunneling through the particular and the individual. And that's the key of storytelling. If you just tell one person's, in this case, two people's stories, maybe you can start to hint at the stars above the clouds, but you're just playing around in the dirt most of the time.
We've got a question about lore, you know, why make her blind? But I'm curious about how you got inside of that experience so well. Did you actually experiment with it, counting steps, counting buildings, or blindfolding yourself?
Yeah, I get that question a lot. It's funny. You know, for me, the bigger breach was trying to cross cultures. You know, being a bald Caucasian guy in Idaho at the supermarket, for me, it was harder to try to imagine myself as a French girl in the 1930s rather than blindness. I had one of my very early short stories had a visually impaired protagonist called the Shell Collector, and I've always just been interested in how to challenge myself using sentences to transport a reader that don't rely as heavily on visual imagery, that can rely on textures and smells and sounds, and so that has always been something I've been very interested in. But yes, I have my boys blindfold me and walk me around, and you do quickly get a sense of that vulnerability, although I think a blindfold is really in no way any even a metaphor, even a beginning to understand what it's like to be fully visually impaired. And then I read lots and lots of memoirs, you know, looking for people who had maybe had sight as kids and lost sight. One of the most important ones is something called And There Was Light by Jacques Lusseron, a Frenchman who lost his sight when he was a boy. His parents just treated his disability in such a beautiful way that, you know, they never treated it as a tragedy. They emptied a room in their apartment in Paris of furniture, and that was where he could go play and imagine himself. And he writes beautifully about color. He saw the world in terms of color. And as soon as I saw that, I knew I wanted Marie to have that kind of attitude towards her disability, too.
You mentioned a little bit about getting into the character of Werner, you know, this young boy seeing that photograph. I just wanted to read this because it's so lovely. Thank you so much for portraying some Germans as human beings. I lived my first 50 years with guilt and shame. The next years, I learned to live with responsibility and memory. It's wonderful that you pick St. Malo, one of my favorite places, Danke.
Oh, that's so nice.
It is quite nice, but I wonder about that. Was there anxiety when you were writing about this character?
Of course. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, in many ways, I invented von Rumpel, this gemologist who's hunting this stone in the novel, to try to give a reader a Nazi or a German who we were more used to seeing, because I worried so much about making Werner too empathetic. I think ultimately he has a lot of moral failings, and I hope they become clear to the reader. As you see Jutta, his sister, and Frederick operate in the novel, they're have much clearer moral pictures about what's right and wrong. Werner really tries to keep his head down, focus on engineering. He's not really a political animal, and I think that's to his detriment, and maybe that's to all of our detriment. I hope the reader will ask herself along the way, you know, what kind of things am I being complicit in right now? If you're an American citizen growing up, it's not necessarily, of course, to the level of the Holocaust, but what kind of things are we complicit in, you know, whether it's drone strikes or our use of single-use plastics, or in my case, flying around in airplanes all the time? Like, what kind of things are we doing that our grandkids will judge us harshly for when they come around?
I know that you've talked in the past about writing this book when thousands of World War II veterans die every single day. And putting the memory, creating the stories that people, contemporary readers, would find interesting. But, you know, you also mentioned a little bit about the rise of nationalism. This is going on all over Europe, anti-immigration fervor, you know, fascism. But it doesn't look like it used to look. And I wonder about the kind of moral questions that you see us asking ourselves now as we're watching, in many places, the rise of fascism.
Yeah, oh gosh. I feel like the book is really, this novel is about technology, as I was trying to bring up. You know, the seed, as you mentioned, is about radio. And so I hope we are asking ourselves questions about how are these new technologies being used right now. You know, YouTube is this amazing thing. You can teach yourself to repair a tractor. You can teach yourself Farsi on YouTube. You know, my son is like making ravioli and tortellini by watching these videos of these old Italian ladies making tortellini. That's an incredible educational tool. But at the same time, something like YouTube or Twitter are being used to radicalize young people or to recruit for ISIS. And is that YouTube's responsibility? Is that our responsibility? You know, how do we police these things, if we're policing them at all? Just last week, the federal government was asking Twitter to divulge the identity of an account that was being critical of the Trump administration. Thankfully, you know, Twitter refused. But, you know, that kind of, those kind of legal challenges are scary. And you wonder, you know, what is the role of these new, are the, of these new technologies? Are you talking to your kids about them? Are we talking to ourselves about them and how we use them?
Question from the audience here. How do you know when you've got the sound, the music, the words of a sentence just right for all that you're trying to convey, and choose those words? That's one comment and note that's been made many times in this book, that the words, the poetry of the language.
Yeah, that's something I spend tons of time on. I don't know if I'm good at it, but I'm trying. You know, just like that picture of, like, say, salt and pepper, you know, a lot of sentences, they come out and they just look like salt and pepper on the table. They look sort of dull, you know. I will choose combinations of words that I've seen thousands of times before, like the sun will glint on the water, or, you know, the crystal is clear. It's a crystal clear day. And then it's only on revision you start reading through and you're like, you know, what is clear about a crystal, and why am I evoking a crystal here? And can I disrupt the order, the sequence of language that people are used to seeing to try to make it a little bit sharper and clearer? You know, you don't want to exhaust your reader, but you do want your reader to feel awake. You don't want your reader to sleepwalk through sentences. And so, you know, I'm always trying to avoid regular combinations of words that come immediately to me. And the beauty of writing is that you have revision. You get to go back and fix it.
You're listening to my conversation with Anthony Doerr, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of All the Light We Cannot See, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage.
How about the chapters? Why did you write them in the non-chronological order is this question. When was this decision made? And I'm wondering myself, did you write one full story chronologically, then the other, and start to fold it together?
Yeah, good question. So not only do the chapters alternate back and forth between Mahri and Werner, but there are 13 books inside of this novel, and they move back and forth in time. A lot of it was motivated by anxiety. I was, like most things in my life, I was asking a reader to wait like 480 pages for these two characters to intersect, and I thought she would never be patient enough to wait that long unless I gave her some hints that these two parallel lines were actually slightly inclined toward each other and would intersect. So I knew I wanted to start the book with a suggestion that they would be awfully close to each other. So that was one thing. And then the other thing was, I wanted, as I mentioned a little bit, I wanted the book to feel like maybe the spiral of a shell, or I wanted it to feel a little bit like the map of Saint-Malo from above, to feel like this labyrinth that the reader's moving herself through, like a puzzle she has to solve herself. So I thought one way to do that was to disrupt the chronology as well. So really, I'm asking a reader too much. I'm asking her to keep four plates spinning: Mahri during the siege of Saint-Malo, Werner during the siege of Saint-Malo, and then Mahri in all the years leading up to that siege, and Werner and all those years leading up to it. So that's another reason I did shorter chapters. I felt like to keep touching those plates in the reader's mind, just leave them on the page briefly, then let her keep moving through them.
Hmm. And when you're creating this universe, of course, we have a lot of big historical facts that we know about what was going on in Brittany at that time in the World War. So when you're writing a novel like this, when does the permission to invent come? Like, what's the line for you? How deeply do you go? Is it down to the city, down to the building, or to create something that is true or factually true?
Yeah, really good question. In Saint-Malo, now I guess there are tours you can take with like an app or something. God knows how this stuff starts, but like you can walk around the novel somehow in the city. And then occasionally people get angry with me and they're like, well, we tried to find the bakery and it's not there. So I feel like... There is a license, but there is so much more responsibility. I mean, to not make jokes, the important thing, so important that you mentioned, it's not just veterans of these wars, but we're losing everybody for whom the Second World War is memory every day, losing thousands of them, and it's transitioning much more into history. And history is a more malleable thing. And, you can see how politicians invoke the Second World War as this time of moral clarity. And I think it's really important to remember it wasn't that long ago, and it was an extremely complicated time. And so I try to make sure, like if I'm going to say it was raining on a certain day, I try to make sure I have the meteorological records and see if it actually was raining on that day. I have the luxury of having invented people, but trying to get the streets to intersect correctly, you know, get the right birds, the right snails in the right place, although there's always the annoying marine biologist from Woods Hole or something who's like, "Dear Anthony, technically that mollusk would not have been present during that season." But you're knitting a dream. When you're writing fiction, you're knitting this dream together, and you don't want the reader to wake up. And the only way to wake her up is to, put a thread out of place. And so sometimes, you want to get every single one of those details right. And I think it's the first printing of the novel. I have Etienne, Marie's uncle, who talks about listening to foreign broadcasts when he was a kid. He says, "Anna, we used to get Pakistan on our shortwave radio."
Oops.
So the tide of letters starts coming in pretty quickly. It's like, Pakistan was not technically a country till 1947. And you're like, oh, God, right, of course, crap. So the amazing thing about ebooks, though, that is so lovely, is that I can email my editor and like literally overnight, like your Kindle's just sitting there on the nightstand, but overnight, it's like, bloop, Pakistan's replaced. So you can fix errors more quickly. But in later printings of the novel, Pakistan is gone.
How about the research into how the resistance used radio? Was that true? Did they use radio in that
way? Oh, sure. Yeah, especially on the Eastern Front. I mean, the Eastern Front is this incredible geography, Maine to Florida, basically. And the extermination of people, not just during the Holocaust, but the extermination of this whole generation of young Russian men. These partisans with much more inferior technology risking their lives to broadcast as codes or locations, incredible heroism. I hope throughout the novel, if you get a chance to read it, you're asking yourself, what would I do in these situations? And, certainly I don't know if I would have been brave enough to do the things that happened. I certainly wouldn't have been brave enough to be, say, Frederick in the novel, who really recognizes that what's going on around him is morally wrong. We're all in those positions all the time in life, but never so stark as in wartime.
Mm. And those accounts, too, the training of the Hitler Youth or the soldiers specifically, where did you find out about that?
That's all real. I found mostly through diaries and journals. In fact, in some ways, I minimized the level of violence at these schools. These schools were predicated on bullying and really about driving the weakest members out. And for all the things that are, bummers about America right now, we've really got a good consciousness of bullying coming up in the past 10 years. And you think it wasn't that long ago that kids were being bullied. There, at one point, I mentioned the novel just for a half of a sentence. They play this game where they'd have 10 red flags and 10 blue flags, 20 boys. Each boy gets a flag, and you say the game's over when one group of 10 has all the flags. And that's what you did. It's cool.
How about the Sea of Flames? The story behind that sounds like myth. It sounds like a legend that could have been true. Where did that come from for you?
The more you start reading about these gemstones, especially valuable ones, museums love to foster these stories because they drive attendance and they maybe deter theft, is what they say, if there are curses. I read about this, it's called the Delhi Sapphire in the British Museum. I've never seen that stone, but supposedly very rational people, scientists in the museum, believe this stone is cursed. In the 80s, a guy was driving it to a symposium, and his car got hit by lightning. And then his wife got really sick, and he's convinced it was because of the sapphire. And I love the way, my mom is a science teacher, And she, you know, is also a very devout Catholic, and she reconciles all these things beautifully. There's this mass where the priest is like, the woman will be subservient to the man in all ways. It's like a reading from the Bible. And you can see the smoke like rising out of my mom's head. But she reconciles that, you know, she finds value in that hour on Sunday thinking about larger things. And I love that she's a scientist with some superstitions too. There's something wonderful about, very human about that. So I wanted the Sea of Flames to be a way to play with superstition and myth and also rational science and see if those things, because they coexist within us.
Mm. Well, we got a glimpse of some of the things that you're interested in that led you to writing. And with such wide interests and so many things, I'm wondering about the process of narrowing it down for a book. You stopped writing this book in the process to write a memoir. I mean, right. How do you reel it in, I guess?
Yeah, no, attention can be my problem. I get really excited about things, and then maybe you can tell. Sometimes deadlines, artificial deadlines or otherwise, really help keeping you focused. And sometimes your wife has to have a little talk with you. But I also am guilty of trying to cram things in. Like, I'm just cramming. I'm like, okay, oh, yes, I'll totally make this about snails. And like, oh, okay, now shortwave radios. I'm going to read about that. And I'm going to build a little crystal set. And then I'll put that in the book. But taking a break, for me, you know, this was 10 years, but I was reading so often about the destruction of human beings that I would take a break to try to work on other projects, also just to relieve some of that psychological pressure. You know, when you work alone, and some days you just, all you see is your wife and kids, you know, sometimes you need a little break. So I would write pieces for Condé Nast Traveler, or, you know, write a newspaper piece I wrote for the Boston Globe. Most of the time I was working on this book, too. So, you know, Also, there's a reward in finishing something short. You know, you get, if you finish something 1,000 words long and it's done and the editor's like, okay, it's going into print, it feels kind of good. You're like, okay, right, I can still finish something even though I can't seem to finish this novel.
Do you have any advice for a new writer who has a passion project to nurture?
Of course. Read. You know, I think read widely. Just if you want to be a literary fiction writer, it doesn't mean you shouldn't read everything. You know, read the newspapers, read short stories, read poems, read magazines, read teen romance if you want. You know, I think finding those things that turn you on will always can refill the well and get you excited about writing. And then the classic discipline of the chair, they call it, you know, just butt time. Put your butt in a chair or get a stand-up desk if you want to be fancy. And just grind, you know, you've got to be there. It's just like all the athletic metaphors. The more you practice your putts, the more you practice your free throws, the better you'll get. The more time you spend on something, the more times you build a narrative start to finish, the better you're going to get at it. So I think it's just a matter of discipline and reading, looking at the masters. The great gift we have here in the United States is that for free, you can go into a library and study the masters who have come before you. And that's something to not take for granted. Mm.
We actually spoke to Elizabeth Gilbert on this stage after her phenomenal success with Eat, Pray, Love, and she was talking about what it felt like after that, that looking at her life and thinking, you know, my greatest success might be behind me. And I wonder about, you know, you've written a Pulitzer Prize-winning book. It was an Oprah book pick on the New York Times bestsellers list for 3 years. So is there some voice in your head when you're sitting right down to write the next one that says, oh my gosh, how am I going to do this?
Maybe, but I think it all depends on how you define success. You know, I think it's really important to ask yourself and your kids that. You know, for me, the real happiest times in my life are like at my kids' flag football practices at the rain, you know, wrestling with them, and they don't think of me as a writer, and I'm not thinking of myself as a writer at that time. So yeah, in terms of, you know, capitalism, you know, maybe this book was more successful than my previous ones, but I'm not sure it's necessarily a better book than the other four. You know, you're just at different places in your life, and so as long as I can rein in my agent's expectations and my publisher's expectations on the next book, you know, in terms of how many book clubs in Tampa Bay are going to read it, I think, you know, it'll be fine. I don't feel that kind of pressure. In fact, it's kind of, it's a lightening in a lot of ways. You know, to win the Pulitzer means that if my next book is like 1,900 pages, my publisher still might print it. It's kind of amazing.
I'm Virginia Prescott. Please do join me in thanking Anthony Doerr. Anthony Doerr, author of All the Light We Cannot See, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. NHPR's president is Betsy Gardella. Producer and communication director is Margaret Talcott. The live sound and recording and mixing engineer is Ian Martin. Bob Lord and Dreadnought provide live music. Broadcast producer for NHPR is Taylor Quimby. Music Hall production manager is Shauna Morris. Music in this episode from Broke for Free and Blue Dot Sessions. You can listen to more author interviews and see some photographs from the series at wordofmouthradio.org. Click on the Writers on a New England Stage link. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this has been a special broadcast of Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
The regulations don't cover.